In a few days, dozens of children from all across the state are coming together in a special camp that lets them spend time with their moms, who are also inmates. The organizer of the Mom and Me camp says it serves an important purpose.
To bring these families together, to give them hope at being together and being healthy and whole again in a way they may have never known.
Later, we speak with the organizer behind one of the state's newest Black Lives Matter movements, who had one of their first events this past weekend in Springfield.
So the community conversation that we had on Saturday at the library was just our way to reach out to the community of Springfield and find out what issues were important to them and what they'd like to see the chapter accomplish once we're able to get that up and established.
And Raja Krishnamoorthy, who's campaigning for Tammy Duckworth's seat in Congress, joins us live from the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've all been hearing about the Democratic National Convention underway in Philadelphia. We wanted to have a guest on to start the show who's actually there in Philadelphia. Raja Krishnamoorthy is the Democratic candidate for Illinois' 8th Congressional District in the Chicago suburbs. The seat's currently being held by Senate candidate Tammy Duckworth. Krishnamoorthy is running against Republican Pete Diaciani. He's a native of Peoria, a graduate of Princeton University and Harvard Law School. Krishnamoorthy lives in suburban Chicago, where he's currently president of Siva Labs. Hi, Raja. Welcome to the 21st. Raja, are you there? Looks like we're having a problem getting a hold of Raja. Let's try him back there for a minute. As we were just talking about, that's the seat that's currently being held by Senate candidate Tammy Duckworth. She's also scheduled to be speaking at the Democratic National Convention. Last night we heard from U.S. Representative Luis Gutierrez as well, and they will all be part of the Democratic National Convention. Sorry about that. Technical delays. Looks like we've got Raja Krishnamoorthy on the line with us. Hi, Raja. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. How are you?
Good. So this is your second Democratic National Convention, your first as a candidate. How is it different this time around?
My participation is a little more structured this time around. Last time I was basically an observer, and it was a lot of But this time around, I had a chance to visit different caucuses and, share the vision of my campaign and find out, what like-minded progressives are doing elsewhere in the country as well.
And you did, so you had a kind of a series of events yesterday. You spoke to three different groups. Let's start with the Illinois delegation breakfast. Now, for people who aren't familiar, you previously served as deputy state treasurer. I know that Attorney General Lisa Madigan at one point appointed you as a special assistant attorney general. Did you know pretty much everyone in the room at the Illinois delegate breakfast yesterday morning?
I knew a lot of them.
Okay.
I saw a lot of familiar faces, a lot of friendly faces. So it was fun having a chance to interact with them and, of course, to address them.
And I know later you spoke with the Asian American and Pacific Islander Caucus. If elected, you would actually be the second Indian American ever elected to the U.S. Congress. Is that something that you think about?
Well, the small correction, I believe I would be the fourth. Because there was one who was elected in the 50s, and Bobby Jindal in the 90s, in the early 2000s.
Oh, sorry, I meant the House of Representatives. Now. Right, sorry, the second to the House of Representatives. Right.
So, I think about it because I think about my own parents and my own personal story. Unfortunately, as a child, my family fell into some desperate economic circumstances, but thanks to the incredible generosity and goodwill of the people of the United States, we were allowed to move into public housing and food stamps. And so I spent about half of my childhood in those circumstances. And but thanks to this country, you know, we were allowed to remain until we could get on our feet and find a job in, of all places, Peoria, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my parents spent the next 40 years of their lives, you know, educating their two boys in public schools and entering the middle class. And so, you know, everything about this country has been revered in my family. And as an Indian American, as a child of immigrants, we've received so much, and America owes us nothing, but I owe everything to America.
You're also a small business owner, and you were addressing yesterday the Democratic National Committee, the Small Business Council. What did you talk about?
Well, you know, I believe that small businesses are the engine of job creation and growth in this country. And, you know, my company, basically, we make and sell infrared night vision technology as well as solar technology based on a certain type of semiconductor that was pioneered at the University of Illinois, Chicago, 30 years ago. And so what I talked about are a few things. One, we have to do everything we can in this country to help small businesses, you know, grow and strengthen their businesses. We have to do everything we can to put them on a level playing field with their larger corporate competitors. For instance, you know, most small businesses pay the full corporate tax rate, while a lot of larger corporations don't, because they have access to lawyers, accountants, lobbyists, who can create loopholes that basically allow them to avoid, you know, paying full corporate tax rates. And the third thing I talked about was innovation being the key to our prosperity as an economy, and how small businesses are really the, you know, are really where that innovation happens in the first instance, in a lot of cases.
Roger, what do you think the business biggest issues are facing small business owners here in Illinois?
I think uncertainty more than anything else. As you know, our state has not been able to balance its budget in a long time. And a lot of vendors in the state go unpaid for long stretches of time, even after rendering their services. And so, you know, when you have that uncertainty about the future, you know, small businesses and others, they think about, you know, potentially being in places where there is more certainty and more predictability. And so I'm very upset that, unfortunately, you know, big egos and personalities have gotten in the way of actually, you know, coming to terms on a budget agreement and getting the trains running on time in Springfield.
You were on the floor last night hearing people like Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Michelle Obama. I know you previously worked for President Obama back when he made a successful run for the U.S. Senate. What speech left the biggest impression on you yesterday evening?
Oh, I was floored by a Michelle Obama speech. It was outstanding. I know that there was a lot of positive responses outside of the hall, but even inside the hall, it was extremely moving. And, you know, more than any other speech, I feel like she was able to get at the essence of what we're trying to do in this election, which is trying to elect somebody who we will be proud to help guide the future, not only for us, but for our children in the next 4 and 8 years. And I think that, you know, as a mother of two, you know, adult daughters, young black women, as she called it, you know, she has a firsthand perspective on this particular issue. And as parents, I don't want Donald Trump, you know, talking to my kids or, you know, basically giving cues on how to conduct yourself or how, you know, we should kind of lead, you know, the affairs of our society.
Roger, one last quick question for you. We've heard a lot about the Bernie Sanders supporters being very vocal and shouting out people during yesterday, at least the first day of the convention. What are you hearing? Are you seeing, is it a little calmer today, or what kind of things are you hearing from people?
Yeah, I think so. I think that you know, Bernie Sanders did a great job last night of really giving a full-throated case for why Hillary Clinton should be elected president. And, you know, he went through provision by provision of the platform that you know, exemplifies kind of the unity, at least philosophically, between the Sanders folks and the Clinton perspective. And so I think that, in conjunction with Michelle Obama's speech and other speeches, have served to calm things down. And, you know, I look forward to hearing more positive voices tonight as well.
Raja Krishnamoorthy is a Democratic candidate for Illinois' 8th Congressional District, which covers Cook, DuPage, and Kane counties. Raja, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We've been talking about how communities across Illinois are having conversations about race, policing, and violence. Last week, we heard about efforts in Decatur. Today, we're talking about Springfield. Black Lives Matter Springfield held their first meeting this weekend, where more than 75 people participated in a community conversation. Organizers say they plan to take those concerns and comments to local police. Joining us now is Sunshine Clemens. She's one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter Springfield. Sunshine, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You had a conversation at the library in Springfield on Saturday. What did you hear from people?
We had a variety of attendees, so there were a variety of messages that were brought forth. We had some questions and concerns on the community policing program that the police have, body camera issues. We're in a pilot program for our body cameras here, but our sheriff's office declined to participate in that, so someone brought that up as a concern. There were some mentions of the Community Review Commission and how they, you know, how it's an active commission that has not, you know, met in years. There were also some questions about the shoot to kill policy, how they're trained to shoot to kill and not shoot, and never to shoot to disarm, things along those lines. So there were a variety of issues and concerns and subjects that people brought up.
And Sunshine, I know you're hoping to take these issues to local police. How much contact have you had with the local police within Springfield?
Prior to the rally, we have reached out to the police and the sheriff's office, made sure they were always aware of what we were doing, invited them to participate if they were able. So we've been in contact with them the entire time.
What got you first involved in this effort to want to start a specific, I don't know if chapter is the right word, but just a group of people in Springfield who want to be affiliated with the National Black Lives Matter movement?
I've always been community-minded. I've always been active in my community doing different things. I'm a mentor through Big Brother, Big Sister. So I've always been a person who believes that, you know, making the community work is something that you should do in your home, in your surrounding areas, making your community better one person at a time. But as far as specifically the Black Lives Matter, it's something that I've supported since, you know, its first inception a few years ago. But after the killing of the two gentlemen within, you know, 48 hours, I think that was just kind of a peak point for me. And it was just, you know, I was ready to do more than just verbally support or attend, you know, other people's rallies. I wanted to get out and do something myself, along with my friend who I'm working with.
And how would you say the community in Springfield has reacted to, as you said, not just Alton Sterling and Philando Castile, but also the deaths of police officers in Dallas and now New Orleans?
The community that I've been interactive with is outraged at the treatment by police officers on minority communities, as well as some of the retaliatory things that we have seen. And I don't want to call them retaliatory in the respect of you know, because the people that have done those things to the police have not been associated with Black Lives Matter. That's not something that we advocate for. We're not, you know, anti-police. We're not against the police. So I don't want to say retaliatory in the respect that it's stemming from something that the police did to the minority communities. But we are still, you know, hurt and outraged at harming police officers who may not be in the wrong, just as we are against them harming, you know, our communities.
Sunshine, where do you all go from here? What do you want to happen next?
Well, our next step is we're working on meeting with the police to bring forth the issues that the community presented to us on Saturday. So we're in the process of working on that now. We wanted to go to the police armed with not only our concerns, but with concerns directly from the community that the police protect as well. So that's our next step. We're all also working on another event for August. So we're continuing to progress. We're not an official chapter yet, but we're continuing because we know that is something that we plan to become, but because there's been so much outreach as far as people trying to start chapters, I was told by another local chapter that there is a freeze on starting chapters.
Okay.
We cannot become a chapter yet, but that is a goal of ours when we are able to, when that freeze is lifted. So right now we're just progressing as an organized group of people who have the goal of becoming a chapter.
That's Sunshine.
We feel the need. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no. Go ahead. Finish your thought, please.
I say we don't feel the need to. We don't have to wait until we're an organized chapter to continue, because the community is, you know, has shown a lot of support for this. It's something that they're interested in. So until then, we'll just keep, you know, doing what we can do until we reach that point where we can become official.
Thanks for that. That's Sunshine Clemens. She's co-founder of Black Lives Matter Springfield. Thanks for joining us, Sunshine.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Apologies for that line there. Looks like we're having some technical difficulties today. We're going to be working on that. Coming up, we're going to be speaking with an artist, an Urbana native, who's been doing artwork in New Orleans. So stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about conversations that are happening not just in Illinois, but across the country around race, policing, and violence. Urbana native Langston Alston recently moved to New Orleans and has been using his artwork to help continue the conversation over race and social injustice. Alston was one of the artists who helped contribute to murals that were painted outside the Alton Sterling Memorial earlier this month. And he joins us now to talk about his art and the role that he sees art playing in this conversation. Langston, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Now, I know you didn't originally plan on going to Baton Rouge to do art at the Alton Sterling Memorial. How did you end up there?
Well, I was following the news that came in about shooting, you know, kind of as it was happening. And I realized, I guess the morning after the shooting occurred, that I had to be at the site. You know, I had to see it. It was something that was like too close and too painful for me to ignore. And so I got a ride from a friend and went up there initially just to kind of talk to the people that were there and to like protest in a broad sense. And I got the opportunity to paint, and I just kind of ran with it because that was cathartic for me, and it ended up being a little bit cathartic for the community as well.
What did you paint?
I painted a protester at the site. So there was a Baton Rouge native that was already coming to do the portrait of Alton Sterling. It's been, kind of been published a lot, and he did it on the actual store. But there was a building next door where I ended up painting a protester named Will Smurf that we had met earlier in the day. And he was so vocal and so, like, personally moved by the event that I thought that, you know, by painting him, it allowed me to create kind of an emblem, not just for the individual tragic death of Alton Sterling, but also the protest and the activism that had kind of erupted in the community in the wake of that.
Langston, has your artwork always focused around social issues?
Yeah, I would say so. I think growing up, I was very well educated about, you know, struggles against injustice and struggles against racism in this country. That's always been not just source material, but stuff that has been, like, you know, close to me personally and important for me to touch on with my art and my voice.
And I know that your murals, you have murals up around Central Illinois, particularly in Urbana, but can you describe your style of art for people who aren't familiar? How would you describe your work?
I guess that's a little bit difficult. It's influenced by
But I have other artists. I think it's kind of easiest for me to just think about other artists when I'm describing it. So it's influenced by Emery Douglas, who did the revolutionary artwork for the Black Panthers, and then also a lot of comic book artists, because I grew up around a lot of comic books. And then, you know, like cartoons, comic books, and revolutionary art, I think are the places where I draw the most inspiration from and where my style kind of evolves from.
How do you think artwork can help ensure that conversations can tend to continue? Because I think often when you have, I think certainly we're in a moment in this country where there's a national conversation that's been ongoing now for several years, but certainly that conversation sort of peaks and ebbs and flows around specific incidents. And I wonder if you feel that artwork can help ensure that the conversations maybe continue at a more more kind of constant pace.
Right. Word. I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot recently because I personally like have to make art. That's a part of my life, and it's, you know, important to me. And I have to express these issues through art because they're things that are constantly on my mind and constantly in the media. And I feel like, to some extent, art can be an answer to some of the more insensitive or shock-oriented media coverage that exists about issues like police violence. Because I feel like there's this constant battle, to a certain extent, against the way that mainstream media tends to portray these issues as maybe being not so much of a big deal, or as individual incidences of, like, bad policing or a bad individual action, rather than, like, a holistic, large-scale problem. So I think that, you know, by putting art out into the world that celebrates actual humans and elevates them and their role in this conversation, and also that talks about it as a holistic issue and continues to be like an emblem for how these problems are ongoing, can be, you know, an important way to add to the conversation that already exists in media and maybe make it a little bit slower of a read and a little bit more compassionate, hopefully.
Langston, it's interesting you say that, because I know that your recent work has been different from your previous art, in that you previously, as you've said, sort of like to paint maybe broader issues and sort of broader themes instead of specific incidents. But why do you feel like it's important now to be painting and doing art that focuses on these specific incidents?
Well, I mean, I'm in New Orleans, which is an hour from Baton Rouge, and so that, like, basically happened, you know, right by me. And so to ignore that, the murder of Auburn Sterling was kind of impossible for me. And so I had to touch on it, and I had to get out, you know, some emotions pretty quickly. And the best way I felt to do that was to talk about the issue specifically and do it through art and through murals. But it's also, you know, it's a time when people are, I think, being more aware, like, there's a revolutionary conversation in the country now that has been kind of absent, I think, for a while. And so adding to that conversation with art, I think, can be really moving for people and really important for helping people understand what that conversation is and what their role in it can be.
Yeah. That's interesting, because I, you know, as we're thinking about this and I'm thinking about artists, and certainly we've heard musicians, and there's a strong culture, especially in this country, of protest songs and protest movements. And I'm thinking about Janelle Monáe and how much her music has been, you know, embraced by Black Lives Matter and how much she's written, and obviously now more recently Beyoncé. But when you're thinking about art, I wonder, what role do you want your art to play, and what role do you think art should be playing in the Black Lives Matter movement, or bringing people into the conversation?
I mean, I think it really is just that, is bringing people into the conversation and making people feel as though they're important, you know, making people feel as though they're heard and their actions are resonating. Because sometimes I feel like you can get the sense that you're speaking into a vacuum or speaking, like, preaching to the choir, you know, when you go to certain events or you're circulating around like-minded people, but maybe you aren't seeing change happening on a larger level. And so just, like, adding, like, a visual element or adding a musical element to that can energize people in a way that sometimes just, like, the raw day-to-day
action can't necessarily do. And I love working with musicians because I feel like actually during the actual act of protest and the action around injustice, like music is extraordinarily critical. So, yeah, I think it's just really about bringing people into the conversation and making the conversation louder, amplifying it.
Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us. It's Langston Alston, an Urbana-born artist. He's now living in New Orleans and creating his pieces and art around, as he's been explaining, social issues, particularly around the Black Lives Matter movement. We've tweeted out, by the way, Langston's murals. If you follow us at 21st Show, 21ST Show, you can see that. Hey, Langston, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
As we talk about this conversation over violence by and against police, yesterday, Michael Jordan released a rare public statement saying he was deeply saddened by the recent violence against Black people and expressed anger over violent responses against police. In an essay entitled "I Can No Longer Stay Silent" that was released to The Undefeated, an ESPN website dedicated to race and sports, Jordan wrote that the problems we face didn't happen overnight and they won't be solved tomorrow. But if we all work together, we can foster greater understanding, positive change, and create a more peaceful world for ourselves, our children, our families, and our communities. Michael Jordan is, of course, now the owner of the NBA Charlotte Hornets. He's been criticized for being mostly silent on political issues during his career. But yesterday, in addition to that statement, he donated $1 million each to the Institute for Community Police Relations that's newly created by the International Chiefs of Police, as well as the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. This week, several dozen children are traveling to East Bay Camp near Bloomington to participate in a special three-day summer camp. In the evenings, they'll be doing traditional summer camp activities, think swimming, nature hikes, and campfires. But during the day, these campers are traveling to two women's correctional facilities in Decatur and Lincoln to spend time with their mothers, who are inmates there. Joining us now to talk about the Mom and Me Camp on the line from Normal is the program's director, Kathy Case, and Kevin Cook, the dean of the boys' camp. He's been a volunteer since the program began 15 years ago. Kathy, Kevin, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Kathy, can you tell us what the program is about and how this all got started?
Well, it all got started over 15 years ago when Lincoln Correctional Center was a men's facility and turned into a women's facility. I mean, the state of Illinois does those kind of things. The chaplain at the time, Lori Taki, saw that as an opportunity to have more programs, and he knew that the women needed to be in touch with their children during the time that they were incarcerated to, you know, increase the hope that they would be a better family afterwards. So he sought out volunteers, and he found Shirley Ryan, who thought that she could do all of this. This was just wild that she thought she could do all of this. And a camp, and they went to East Bay Camp at Lake Bloomington, and they thought that they could do all of this. And to make a long story short, all people plus a bunch of volunteers, including Kevin, went out there and tried this out 15 years ago, and it's continuing to this day.
Where do the children come from, Kathy?
They come from all over the state. The mothers that are incarcerated may be from southern Illinois. They may be from the Chicago area. The children are coming not only from in-state. There are some family members that are taking care of kids in Wisconsin. So the kids are from all over.
And I imagine there's so many challenges faced by families affected by incarceration. In fact, we've done some extensive conversations on this on previous shows on the 21st. So when we get a chance, we're going to tweet out those links so everyone can see those other conversations we've had, particularly about children who have incarcerated parents. But I wonder if you can, from your time with working with these families, what do you think are the biggest challenges that are faced by families where parents and especially moms are in prison and their children, as you said, are all over?
Well, a lot of it comes in just the access to the child. There's a lot of caregivers that can't bring the children down to visit because they don't have a car, because they don't have any alternative transportation to get to them. So the mothers and the children are left with some phone conversations. And, you know, this is something, but it's not enough to help a family grow as a family is supposed to, or heal as some of these families need to, from whatever brought the children there. So the caregivers have this incredible task of trying to help heal that child, sometimes by themselves and sometimes with very little help from the mothers, because the mothers can't be accessed.
I know you've received letters from children and from mothers who've participated in this program over the past several years. What kind of things do the families tell you about the impact this program has had on them?
Well, you know, the most recent year, last year, we had a mother who hadn't even seen her son for 3.5 years. And what she said and what she wanted everybody to know was that she wanted to thank them for ending the most hurtful 3.5 years of her life. She said, this was to the volunteers, all of you are like angels sent from heaven. And then, you know, a child wrote that, first he wrote, you are well appreciated. And then he added a sad face that he put below it, me before camp. And then he added a happy face after that. And he labeled me after camp. And then he put in, you made this change possible. I think that that's just the epitome of what we believe that we are doing.
Wow. Sounds like, I mean, for you personally, I imagine, and for all the volunteers, it must be a very meaningful experience for them.
I think it's unbelievable. I think when we get to see those children meet their mothers in prison the first day on Monday, and we watch not only the children running towards the mothers, but the mothers running towards the children, I think what we all feel is this huge sense of hope that this family can finally be healed and be whole.
That's Kathy Case. She's the director of the Mom and Me Camp we've been talking about. It's a program that's been going on for 15 years. This week, several dozen children are traveling to the Bloomington area to take part in this camp. And they spend the evening doing traditional summer camp activities. As Kathy's explaining to us, they get to spend the day with their moms who are inmates. And Kathy's been talking about the volunteers. Let's bring in a volunteer who's been working with this program for the past 15 years. Kevin Cook, as we mentioned, is dean of the boys' camp. Kevin, what made you decide to get involved with this 15 years ago?
Well, I had done some prison ministries, but it actually, you know, all on the male side. And so I even know on the male side of incarceration, as I go and spend time with these guys, that many times that they break out pictures of their children and their families and their wives, and they share them with us. And so you know that that there's a loss there between the parents and the children while they're incarcerated. So I just thought it was a great opportunity to try to do something to help bridge that loss.
What kind of activities do you do with the children?
Well, you know, there's a myriad of things we do. Once again, we have two separate activity centers there. We do the camp, where we do the you know, the traditional types of things that the kids get to, that we sleep in cabins outside. We do the swimming, a lot of swimming. We get to swim, and East Bay has a pool, a traditional swimming pool there, so we'll swim in the pool for a while. Then they have the lake there that we actually get to go, and there's activities at the lake, a giant iceberg, for instance, that you get to climb up and slide off the side, and then a trampoline in the middle of the lake.
So. That sounds like a lot of fun, Kevin. We're going to have to take a break,
sure.
But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Kevin and Kathy, and we're also going to be joined by a local warden. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the Mom and Me Camp. It's a faith-based program that gives young children from across the state of Illinois and beyond the opportunity to spend a few days with their mothers, who are inmates at two women's prisons in Illinois. We've been speaking with Kathy Case, the director of the camp, and Kevin Cook, who's been volunteering since the program began 15 years ago. And we're also joined by Shalith Hansbrough. She's a warden at the Decatur Correctional Facility. Thank you so much for joining us as well, Shalith. Thank you for being with us. Hi there. Can you hear us?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Thank you for having me today.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us. There was a news release that was issued by the Department of Corrections about the camp saying that it was the vision of a chaplain at the Lincoln Correctional Center who envisioned that this would allow mothers and their children to spend time together. Does that explain why you all have chosen to get involved with the Mom and Me camp?
Absolutely. This year will be the 10th Mom and Me Camp at Decatur Correctional Center, when actually it has been a part of the programming for Women and Family Services for at least 15 years now. And so it's just an amazing opportunity to allow mothers and their children to come together, and it really, really helps them be successful with their reentry, because reunification is so important to the mom and the child.
Why do you think it's so important for reentry?
Well, just the transition of the mothers going back home and being able to take care of their children, it's very helpful when we have programs that are in our prisons that allow them to continue being that child's parent. They may not be there on an everyday occasion, but if we're working with them, and this is just one of the programs in the women's division that we work to help them continue to have that bonding experience with their children. And this is one of the best ones that we have, definitely.
Now, Warden, I know the Decatur Correctional Center is a minimum security prison. Regardless of that, I imagine there's quite a bit of accommodations you have to make in order to make this camp possible. Could you tell us what they are?
Absolutely. We make accommodations whenever we're bringing people from the outside into our facility. And yes, we are bringing children in. They definitely are safe in the facility. They are escorted. They are in an area where they will be with their moms, as well as our staff and the volunteers that will be there. We'll make sure that we take care of all of their needs. And it's really been successful each year that we've had it there.
Who's allowed to participate in the program, Warden?
The offenders and their children, they apply to participate on an annual basis. And so the volunteers, and I think you talked to Kathy a little bit today, the volunteers are very involved in going through those applications and working with our staff to determine who would be able to participate. And the other part of that is, you know, caregivers are so very, very important. The caregivers on the outside who are taking care of these children on a daily basis, we also spend time explaining to them the program and explaining how the children are going to be taken care of, because there are some concerns, but we make sure that we try the best that we can to alleviate those concerns, to let them know that their children are being taken care of when they're at the campsite as well as in the prison. And then the caregivers are also given the opportunity to come and participate, and they are also taken care of, so to speak, so that they get a chance to feel that they've been pampered, because it can get very tiring, you know, taking care of someone's children on a daily basis, and we want them to know how much they're appreciated as well.
That's Warden Ashleigh Hansborough at the Decatur Correctional Facility as we're talking about this Mom and Me camp. Kathy, as the director of the camp, I just wanted to ask you about how many volunteers. It sounds like as the warden's explaining what the children are going through, it seems like it's really important to have lots of volunteers involved. How many do you all have with the camp?
Well, this year we have about 60.
And how many children do you have attending this year?
We will have 45 children.
And how does the funding work for this? Is this something, do the children have to pay? How does that work?
No, this is absolutely no cost at all to the children. In fact, the children from the Chicago area are offered a free ride on a bus. And it's a Peoria charter bus that comes down with our Chicago volunteers and with the children whose caregivers. It's easier for them to just hook up with this bus. But all of the food and everything is free to all of the children. We have churches who are involved with us along the way, our own volunteers. You would be surprised at how much money they donate besides their time. I go and talk to churches at different times, and it's just been word of mouth that we have gotten our funding, and we've been able to meet all of our expenses every year.
So this is entirely funded by private donations, this camp?
Entirely, yes.
And have you had, do you only have room for 45 slots? Is there ability to have more children? I imagine there's probably more children who'd love to participate.
We have to turn down children every year. Part of it is the space that we have. When the women came from Lincoln and moved into Logan, we have some smaller rooms that we're using that can only accommodate a certain amount of people. So our space limitations are such, but we still manage to get 30 children into Lincoln. And Decatur also has some space limitations. You know, we just can't call them up and say, you know, make three huge rooms for our children, because that's just not going to happen. We have to fit into their space. So it is a space thing, and I very sadly have to make calls every year to say that I am sorry, but we are already full.
That must be. How do you decide who gets to go to the camp?
It has always been first come, first served. That is how we do it. And, you know, they need to have all their paperwork filled out. And for some, that is more of a challenge than it is for others.
Warden Hansbrough, is it possible to have more space to have for the kids? Is it possible to, as we're hearing about the space limitations, particularly in Decatur?
Well, it really depends on what the volunteers are going to be providing in terms of the classroom exercises. There's structured time with the children as well as free time with the moms. And the location in which we have available for the children, that's really, they're confined to that area. So it's something that we'd have to talk about, but really there's not much more space. Again, this is a prison, and we want to make sure that they're in the safest place possible. It is a minimum security facility, and we do have the volunteers that are there as well as our staff, but we do have to make sure that we're not allowing too many children in such a limited space, because we want to make sure that they are, at the end of the day, taken care of.
And Warden, as we're thinking about this camp, I don't know how unusual this is. Is this something that you feel like you've heard other facilities, particularly women's facilities, do? Or is this something that you think is just really important for you to be doing at the Decatur Correctional Facility?
Well, I know that Decatur and Lincoln, before it became Logan, we've been very involved, because we do, first of all, we take a gender-informed approach to how we work with our female offenders. And, yes, it feels good to see mothers and their children be able to be together. But more importantly, it also reduces recidivism. When you have a mother who's going back out into the community, more often than not, when they have those relationships with their children, they don't want to leave them in the care of someone else. They want to be there with their children. And this camp is just one of those programs that we have that help us to help mothers be better parents to their children and remain outside with them.
You said a gender-informed approach. I'm curious about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, a lot of that is, it's just, you know, programming for prisoners really need to be programs that work for those offenders. For example, a program for a woman offender may not work for the male offender. More often than not, the women are the primary caregivers of these children when they go home. And so when they leave out of the prison, the caregivers have been taking care of them, and for the most part, when they step outside of the doors, before they can even transition and figure out things for themselves, they are given their children to take care of. And so when we talk about gender-informed approaches, we're talking about what is it that is going to help this woman offender be better on the outside? Well, it starts with working with her on her issues on the inside.
As we're thinking about that, Kevin, you're the dean of the boys' camp, and so I imagine the way it works is boys are also welcome into the facility, little boys who are with their moms. What kind of activities are they doing during the day with their moms? Are you there with them as well all the time?
I am with them all the time. As dean of boys, I try to be a constant there for them. Actually, there's three areas inside the prison that we break up into throughout the day. We have a quiet time, which is just where the moms and the kids get to play some games together, do hair together, the things that moms never get the opportunity to do, even when the kids get to come and visit. You know, there's just things, it's a limited space there that they get, and limited activities. So we have a quiet time, we have a craft time where the kids get to do crafts with their mother. And they're really meaningful. A lot of times that we'll take a T-shirt in where the mothers and the kids get to decorate a T-shirt together and put their handprints on there together and sayings to each other. Then there's a gym time where we try to do some games that build that relationship again. We do some relays. We'll do some games where the moms and kids get to play together, which is, you know, once again, inside of a prison, when do you get to play with your children? And so it's a very unique opportunity for both the mothers and the children.
And for as a counselor, Kevin, I imagine this is also, you've been doing this for 15 years. Are the counselors sort of trained to deal with the kids? Because I imagine for some of them, this must be a tough emotional experience and they need additional support during this time.
You know, that once again, they come from varied backgrounds and some of them have regular visits with mothers and have great relationships with their mothers. Again, as Kathy mentioned, we have those children that have not seen their mothers in 3.5 years. So you don't expect them to come in and just automatically take off where, you know, they left off. So there are instances where we keep an eye on those children and the mothers, and we try to do that from a distance because, again, we're not counselors. We don't want to interfere. We want to watch that relationship build and bloom on its own. But if there needs to be intercession, then we've always kind of got them in a corner of our eyes that we can go over there and, you know, try to help that relationship along if we need to.
And what's it like, Kevin, for the children? And Kathy, I'd love for you to weigh in after Kevin answers. But Kevin, what's it like for the children to be with around other kids who are in a similar situation as they are? Because they're in a camp where everyone is just like them. Everyone has a mom who's in a correctional facility.
It's actually a great relief for them. I mean, we hear this every year because they don't have to make up a story about where their mother's at, how come their mother's not at the soccer game. They're all together. They know each one of those other kids there has a mother in prison. They can be themselves. It's pretty cool. They get, I mean, we're only talking about 3.5 days, but the relationships built between the children in that very short period of time is pretty amazing. So very important that they are with other children in like situations.
Kathy, what about you? Do the children have, I don't know if the children have an opportunity, if you have repeat campers who come back, if there are campers who see the same kids every year or have gotten to know each other in that way as well?
You know, we always have children that return. It's we've had kids that have returned 4 years. It's just an age requirement that would keep them away if their mothers are in there for 4 years. We actually had our first camper this year out of the 15 years who is returning this year as a volunteer. He's 23 years old, and he is talking about continuing to be in touch with some of the children that he went to camp with. I mean, what a stronger bond than, look, we're normal here. This is all of us going through this together.
Kathy, what do you want people to know? I mean, as people are listening to this, it's hard for us to imagine what these families are going through. I'm thinking, I don't even know what it's like to walk into a correctional facility, whether you're a kid or an adult. What do you want people to know about this and about these families and these children?
I think that the more that you are involved with the prisons, and there's many of the volunteers that are regular volunteers in the prison doing ministry and so forth, the less you see yourself as being very different. We've all made mistakes, some much bigger than others, and these women have made mistakes. That's the bottom line. They have made mistakes. And some of them came from homes where it's just very understandable that they would make those mistakes because that's what they were taught at home themselves. And I think for us to be able to go in and let them know that they are still loved by their children and that people outside of that facility who are coming in of their own free will because they care about them, there's just, I don't know what more that we can do for their egos than their self-esteem than to know how much they are loved and cared for. Maybe then they can care for themselves and be the mothers that they always wanted to be.
I want to thank Kathy Kay. She's the director of the Mom and Me Camp. Kevin Cook, who's dean of the Boys Camp, and Warden Shalith Hansbrough with the Decatur Correctional Facility for joining me to talk about this. Thank you so much to all of you. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, Midwestern native J. Ryan Straddle joins us to talk about his debut novel, Kitchens of the Great Midwest. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.